Welcome back to another edition of All the Smoke. My guy.
My brother. We're back.
We're back here again. We got a very special guest, someone very close to myself
Real
and Jack.
Special.
A mentor, someone we look up to, someone we are a fan of, Rachel Nichols.
I mean, I'm 5'4", no one's looking up to me. It's very sad.
We still find a way to. Yes. We put you on a pedestal.
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to do serious business here, but before we start, we're taping this on Steven Jackson's birthday.
Right.
So,
special.
Zach,
here you go, Rachel.
Got you a little something.
And the way it's shaped, I know it's a little something I like.
I'm just saying.
Thank you so much,
I'm just saying. Well, I only give alcohol for gifts. There are people in my life who are sober, and then I get to find like a pet rock or something, because this is all I know. So.
Thank you so much.
Dope.
Thank you. Coming with gifts.
How's it feel being old?
It feels great to
be old.
You
look good, though, bro.
Yeah, thank you, bro.
You make old look good.
And especially what we've all been through as a country, as friends and family this last year. It feels good to be here and happy. So
We're celebrating you today. So Rachel, with Jack saying that, what is one thing you took from 2020?
It's funny. We talk all the time like, we should be grateful. We're all so fortunate, all that stuff. I don't think that landed with me enough before 2020. Mm. And I can say that I would have argued with you before. I get it. I don't think it landed with me quite enough to just appreciate all the shit that goes right every day.
Right.
Because there's so much that goes wrong. And it's so easy to get caught up in that. And this isn't fair. And this isn't happening to me. And there's important stuff that we have to channel that into.
Right.
But that's kind of the point. That's the important shit.
Right,
the big injustices, the big things, and the little day-to-day things. I have done a much better job after this year of just not sweating that as much and being able to, if there are little things that come into my mind and life, have them be the good stuff, you know?
Absolutely.
Here we go, Rach. Tell us about your, let's start. Tell us about your upbringing.
Yeah, seriously.
These are conversations that me and you've never had.
I know it.
So tell us about your upbringing.
I'm asking you all these kinds of questions. So
you're on a hot seat today.
I don't know about here.
Well, I think this is one of the things I love about the show, not to even cut you off, but it's just like, Rachel, we know each other, we conversate, we text, we work together, but like when we do stuff like this, you get to learn your friends more.
Yes.
And so I think that shit is dope. So carry on.
Well, you guys know I grew up outside Washington, D.C., which gave me a very tortured sports existence because I grew up being a Bullets fan. And let me explain to you long it has been, right? I always say now. So they played in an arena in Landover, Maryland. They had a different name than the team has now. Mm-hmm. They play in a different state than they have now.
State.
Owned by a different person.
Yep.
So when people say to me like, oh, what NBA team are you attached to? I'm kind of attached to a team that doesn't exist anymore, even though I know the franchise still exists.
Right.
And it's very sad because that franchise has not been in even conference finals in 40 years. So it has been a long desert. And people who are fans of teams that don't do so well are sometimes like, man, you're always ragging on our teams. I'm like, it is the pain I know.
Yeah.
I know this pain.
Share the pain.
I have experienced this pain. The football team, though, was really great when I was a kid, right? They won 3 championships, I think, in like 15 years when I was growing up. So it really gave me that love of sports that was kind of balanced out by the fact that I was a sad, frustrated little girl Bullets fan that wore these Bullets t-shirts that people would laugh at me for. But the important thing is it was enough for me to know like this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I just always felt like I don't want to be in an office. And there were so many paths in sports for women that are available now that frankly just weren't when I was younger.
Yeah.
So this was kind of the way to have a job in sports for me. And it tapped into some things that I'm kind of okay at. And I was able to sort of just pursue that and say, okay, this is what I want to do. But that's where it all came from, is growing up in DC. And just the mix there is pretty awesome. High school basketball there is killer,
right?
Talk to us about your journey, because it wasn't easy. You got pushback. Some people didn't consider sports journalism serious. So talk to us about that and the pushback and what you had to overcome to not only be a woman, but taking what you want to do serious as well.
Well, when I went to college, I had great journalism professors at Northwestern. Again, not the best sports teams. I apparently can only go to places where there's a lot of struggle. But the journalism program is great. And to their credit, because they were trying to help me, they were really trying to steer me into covering news. They were like, you're so smart. You're such a nice girl. You don't want to work in sports. This won't, you know, it's the toy department. That's what people used to call it in newspapers and TV.
Really?
The toy department. That was the thing. And I was just sort of like, no, this is actually what I want to do. And part of the deal at Northwestern is you have an internship program that the school is attached to, and you have to do it. It's for credit. And I wanted to do it in sports. And I had to, like, go present to the board of the college and everything about why the program, about why I wanted to do it. And they'd never done it before, but they finally let me do it. And that led to my first job. And my first job was covering the University of Miami football team back in the 90s when it was the U.
Wild. Yes.
And I graduated from college a little early. I was 21. Ray Lewis was a fifth-year senior for that team, and that team was out of control.
Yeah, that was the NFL team.
In both good ways and tough ways. Yeah. Ray Lewis's roommate was murdered, and Ray came home and found him. I mean, a bunch of shit went down that year.
Uh-huh.
And it was the education of a lifetime of preparing me for the rest of my life in this career, but it was awesome. And if I hadn't kind of convinced them to let me do it in the first place, I never would have gotten that job because that was the place I interned with.
Mm-hmm. Right. Talk about your first time on television.
Oh, man, I was terrible. I'm still not very good. That's the problem, is that the things I'm good at is not what I'm, you know? Like, when I grew up, I don't know about you guys, like, the women on TV, they were tall and blonde largely and kind of very polished and that whole vibe, and that's just not my vibe. You guys are on TV with me. If we make a mistake on the air, it's the first thing I do. I talk about it on the air. I drive the producers crazy. They're like, you don't have to say every time we mess up. But to me, I'd like rather be this like rolling mess in front of everyone.
Right. Real.
Than try to, like, I'm just, you know, and when I started out on TV, I just tried to be that glossy thing.
And it wasn't.
I'm just not that person. So it took me a while to figure out. And Stuart Scott was actually great with me. When I was kind of trying to feel my way, because I think for the beginning for him, a lot of people wanted him to be something he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And he just kept saying to me, he's like, you could be great at being you. You were only going to be like 60 or 70% of being someone else.
Yeah,
and
mm-hmm.
It sounds obvious, but it's hard when everybody looks and acts like this other
way,
thing.
Like a cookie cutter. You've mentioned before, Craig Sager was someone you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Stuart Scott, rest in peace. Who were some of the people you looked up to in this space? Because they're in sports, there wasn't very many women.
For me, so I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, the Washington Post, great newspaper. I think I read that book, All the President's Men, like 40, 50 times. It was very embarrassing that I could like recite it. I wanted to work for the Washington Post. And part of that too was because Tony Kornheiser and Mike Wilbon worked for the Washington Post. A woman named Christine Brennan, who now is with USA Today and does a lot of television on CNN and some other places, worked for the Washington Post. And she was the first female, like, full-time beat writer of an NFL team.
Mm.
She covered the Washington football team, and she was the first woman to do it full-time. But I was a kid reading that, and I didn't know she was the first person to do it full-time. I just knew I opened the newspaper, and I read about the team I liked, and there was a woman who wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just assumed I could do that.
It's normal.
Because I saw it.
Right.
And it wasn't until much later that people kept saying to me, like, come on, you can't really do that. And it was too late because I had already seen her do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that made such an impression on me once later I found out kind of how that dynamic plays. When you're a kid, you don't understand it. But it's why I think now, you know, we use representation as we almost overuse it sometimes.
Right.
It has lost its meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't fucking see anybody doing what you're doing, it is very hard to get there. And if you can see people doing it, it just changes the whole equation. So
Absolutely.
She did that for me.
Beautiful.
You ever had second doubts?
What, the last 5 minutes? Yes.
On choosing your career, you think so?
I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, there's times where I sit there, and whether it's like the practical stuff, if it's 2 a.m. and you're exhausted and you've done X or Y and it didn't go the way you wanted to, and you're like, why am I giving up all the stuff in my life? I mean, I've missed weddings, I've missed family stuff, I missed whatever. There's times where I screw up and you're just sitting there like, okay, really? Like, that came out of my mouth? Why? But I know it's the thing I love. Like, I know I love it. I still love it all the time. And that's what keeps me feeling like I'm doing the right thing, you know?
That's right.
Joined ESPN in 2004, kind of worked your way around different sports, landed with NBA coverage towards the end, and kind of hit the ground running in that space. Talk to us about that journey and kind of finding your path on the stage that ESPN presents.
Yeah, so I started out basically covering what people let me cover, right? So I mentioned college football. One of my early jobs was covering hockey. I liked hockey, but it wasn't like my dream to go into covering hockey, but that's what was available. And that's, you know, I told you guys I wanted to work for the Washington Post. There's a job that opened up in the Washington Post covering the hockey beat. And I had been in this experience where the newspaper I was working at, because I still work in newspapers in Florida, the Florida Panthers go to the NHL, the Stanley Cup Finals, in just their third year of existence. And they didn't have a ton of infrastructure in the media there to cover hockey because it was a brand new team, right? And all of a sudden there was all this interest and all this stuff. And I grew up in the Northeast, and so I knew a lot about hockey. So my old sports editor, who's a great guy, was just like, yeah, I'm throwing you on with the other hockey people. And I had a person in the media, not who worked with me, but who worked in the media down there, who turned to me, like, I don't know, early in a Stanley Cup Finals game and says, Rachel, why does the coach pull all the starters? Why is he pulling all the starters 3 minutes in? And I had to explain that they have line changes in hockey, mm-hmm. and that new guys come over the boards every couple minutes. That's how hockey works. But there was just such a sort of, okay, that's not there. So at the end of that summer, the hockey beat opened up at the Washington Post. I had done a little bit stuff that was by accident. It wasn't mm-hmm. even what I was supposed to do. It's because the team the year before went far, and I got the job. So I did that. And then I covered baseball when they wanted me to cover baseball, and I covered golf when they wanted me to cover golf, and I covered tennis, or I covered whatever. What I really love was football and basketball. And so the more I could try to get in that space, mm-hmm. I wanted to. I like sports where people hit each other, so I thought that was good about covering football. And with basketball, for me, just that there's not a bunch of crap in between you and the game, right? So I'm watching you guys. You are right in front of me. You are 4 feet in front of me. You are doing your thing without equipment all over your face. I can see you. I can see sort of the, like, everything about that drive to the hoop. You experience it in a different way than you do some of these sports mm-hmm. where there's more separation. And the more time I covered the NBA, that drew me in, both from an athletic point of view of where, like, I could fucking see Michael Jordan mm-hmm. do what he was doing, but also just personality wise is like, you can get to know you guys as real yeah. people better. And that was one thing that, I don't know, maybe this is a different perspective coming in as a woman, right? Is that I felt like I could connect with all of you guys in a way that could make you full people, and that I could then turn around and present you as a right. full person. And right. I don't know, you guys tell me, I cover both of you different right. times. Mm-hmm. Like right. if I did that for you, but, yep. but, and if I was able to do it accurately, but that was my hope. I mean, I remember.
You gave me clarity. You helped me get clarity on a lot of, on everything. Every time we spoke, I was able to get clarity. And then I think it was times where I wasn't even the person you were supposed to talk to, but at times. Mm-hmm. Things were misunderstood about me, and you still give me opportunity to clear it up. So that's one reason why we always had a good relationship.
So once you get into this ESPN space, you worked on what they gave you, but mm-hmm. how did you end up in basketball?
I really love the game, so I was always pitching a lot of ideas and a lot of things. And ESPN's changed a lot over the years, mm-hmm. right? We've had the basketball contract for a while, but there have been periods where we did a lot on opening day and then didn't do a lot till Christmas, right? Mm-hmm. And then did a lot of Christmas and then didn't do as much toward the playoffs.
Been all-star.
It wasn't as 365, right?
Right?
And I would kind of be filling in those spaces as being like, well, how about we do this? Well, how about mm-hmm. we do that? Again, I think one of the things I tell people who want to get started in my job, and I'm sure you guys are the same way, like, a lot of it is to just fucking work harder than everybody
yep,
else.
I'll
like,
work.
You have to be the last person in the room. And if you do that, it's not a guarantee that you're going to do great, mm-hmm. but you're probably not going to do great without it.
Right.
So I was constantly willing to be like, oh, I'll take that trip. I'll go. I'll stay an extra day. It's fine. I'll do, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of helped me in the space. And it helped me not only, you know, sort of move around or move up at ESPN, but it helped me, I think, again, with you guys, with the league. People need to see it, mm-hmm. right? And I think after a while, especially someone like me who doesn't look like someone who would naturally be covering the NBA for like 12 reasons, right? Well, you show up every day. And that is something I think this league does better. The guys in this league do better than anyone else. They legit reward work.
Mm-hmm.
And that if you come to the table and you're a worker and you show that like you actually are invested, that matters. And that's frankly not true in every sport. And it's not true with every business or every group of people, but it matters in the NBA. So that helped me too.
Mm-hmm. Who did you enjoy working with besides me?
Mm-hmm,
who did you enjoy working with and have a bond with besides me again?
Well, it's funny. You know, we started the show and I had been pitching doing a daily NBA show. And again, ESPN just wasn't the 365 basketball coverage until maybe the last 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. But we had a great show, NBA Tonight. That was mostly in season, mostly driven around highlights at like, you know, 1 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, there was room to add in a daily afternoon kind of, it's a year-round sport, man. Like mm-hmm. it's year-round kind of conversations and themes and stories and ideas. And I kept pitching this idea, and my elevator pitch for the show when I was sort of at Turner and trying to figure out, do I re-up with Turner? Do I come back to ESPN? Was, hey, what if we had a basketball show that was the afternoon just sitting around with your friends talking about hoop, but one of your friends was Tracy McGrady? And that's like how I kept pitching them. Because for me, I didn't want it to feel like a television show.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of what I said at the beginning about me on TV. I don't think I can like really run like a television show in a very like formal kind of PowerPoint presentation way. I'm not that girl.
Right.
So for me, I was like, what if we just sat around talking like we talk?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the start of it. So T-Mac for me was the one where he had retired kind of in the space that we were trying to do this. And I felt like next to Kobe, he was the guy for so many of today's players.
Ooh. Yes.
And I wasn't sure that some of the people outside basketball understood that.
Right.
The way I did. And I just kept saying like, no, he's the guy. And some of the people who were doing, I mean, they're awesome. They said yes. They gave us the show. They said yes to T-Mac. So there wasn't obviously not that much convincing because they did it.
Right.
But there was a little bit of like, oh, well, how is he on TV? And I just kept saying like, I don't know. We haven't tested him that much, but we don't need to. I said, we can teach him how to be on TV. Right. I can't teach him to be a Hall of Famer.
And
that's kind of the attitude.
That's the information you need.
Right. That's the attitude we've had with everyone. And Steck, it's completely true. Like, you have been one of my favorite people to work with. Matt, you know how I feel about you. Because for me, the guys on that show and the women on that show, it's kind of like a basketball team.
Yes.
You need the Hall of Famers, but you also need the guys who are the blue guys. Mm-hmm. You need the people with this perspective or that perspective, you know? So I just kind of think that we've been so lucky getting a lot of those people on. And look, sometimes now you're off doing your own thing, which is amazing. Don't take him too far away from me for too long. I'm just begging you, please.
He's behind all this, Rachel. I can't take the credit. He's behind it.
I know. Trust me, I know. but it's great because, you know, people come through, then they cycle out for a little bit, then they come back, and it just keeps, it's like your friend. It's like sitting around talking basketball with your friends. It's a great conversation.
Well, congratulations. You just hit the 5-year mark in this past February. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on that. What is it like for you now? Because, you know, you started off in journalism and then you're like a real celebrity in this space because basketball has grown so much.
That is not remotely true.
Don't lie, Rachel.
Rachel, cut it out. Okay, hold on.
I always see in my comments how much people love you.
But
so I know.
I used to tell her the same thing.
She's just being modest.
I used to tell her the same thing. My page just blew up, man. I love Rachel. What Rachel got on today, man. We love Rachel. Look at her hair, man. Rachel, I was showing you that the whole time
but
I was on.
But it was that, too, on they top of the Rachel. I think the fact that obviously the appearance is easy on the eyes, but the fact that, and there wasn't a reason why you have our trust who's because you know what you're talking about too.
So I top. Said,
so it's you're a double-edged sword from that standpoint. But what has that been like without being modest? Like now you're recognized wherever you go now because you're on TV so much and you know what you're talking about.
Well, the answer to all of that is I'm just old. So if you're around long enough, people will just be like, oh yeah, she must be good. She's still here. And I've been doing it for a long time. Yeah. Like that is a big part of it. I was super lucky. I went to Northwestern, as I said. So I was in Chicago. I was in Chicago when Michael Jordan played for the Bulls.
Yeah.
Like.
Prime time. That's
the thing. And then I can keep going back to that. Or, you know, Scottie Pippen's on our show sometimes now. I met Scottie Pippen because I was a little very nervous, even smaller than I am now, as hard as that is to believe. Short human in the Bulls locker room, nervously trying to get up the guts to ask him a question at 19 when I was like stringing for newspaper, trying to like, you know, whatever. So I've been around a long enough time that, yeah, I think it's good. I have earned that trust with people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many basketball games do I probably watch a year? Like 200? Like how many, you know, you do that enough. People get that you have, like we were talking about before, you've done the work, right?
Yeah.
You do all the shit. So,
well, speak on what kind of homework you almost have to do. You said you're a fan of it, but at the same time, I'm a fan, but I get tired of watching that shit. You know what I mean? But you're on TV every single day with like a daytime basketball talk show, and there's nothing like it. So how much preparation, how much time does that take? Because obviously you're a wife, you're a mother, but then you have such a demanding job. You were telling us before we even started your schedule heading all the way through the Olympics. Like your schedule in the next 5 months is crazy.
Yeah.
So talk to us about how much preparation and time it takes to do what you're doing.
Yeah, well, first of all, I'm so lucky, right? If my family wasn't set up and if everyone involved in my family, including my little twins, my husband, you couldn't do it without that, right? So that's the first thing. I could not do this job if it was not set up so that I could. This weekend I'm going to Brooklyn Nets game in Brooklyn. Like, you know, I got children who need to eat. Someone's got to feed them. So I'm very, very grateful. I'm very lucky about that. And then, yeah, it's just kind of constantly being open to having that drift into your day. Mm-hmm. So whether it's, hey, I'm on drive to work, I'm listening to someone's basketball podcast. I listen to All the Smoke. I'm listening to, you know, sort of the conversation that's going on. I'm at work. I'm listening to a bunch of different things and different people. You know, at night, I'm watching at least 2 or 3 games, kind of have on and see what's going on. I read a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is just so that not only can I do the show opens that we do and some of the stuff we do, but I want to be able to be there for you guys. Like when you're talking about something, I don't want you to have to feel that there isn't a safety net of, oh, if I said this wrong guy's name, like mm-hmm. Rachel will be there. She'll kind of set it up mm-hmm. so it's smooth, so it's not a problem later mm-hmm. or anything like that. There's like a little course correct we need to do along the way in a discussion. I'm the one who's got to be able to have that answer. So mm-hmm. I got to do my homework. And I kind of feel like that's why I get to have a seat at that table. I don't want a championship like mm-hmm. you guys. So I didn't play basketball. So my value has to come from doing all that work.
Mm-hmm. You ain't never tried for a team not one time in your life?
Again, pequeño. This, what you see here, is the result of a growth spurt. It is not good. I played soccer growing up because it's low to the ground. Mm-hmm. It's not.
What's it like being able to see former players you work with and kind of their growth and progress? Obviously, you said, you know, mm-hmm. T-Mac, you had him as an infant when it comes to reporting. Paul Pierce has grown.
Yep.
Perk has turned into mm-hmm. a star.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You see me and Jack mm-hmm. start at the beginning and kind of grow. What is that like? Because obviously we all look up to you and got a chance to work with you. So what's that like?
It's killer. Like, we don't have people on the show I don't like.
Right.
So
first and foremost, it's her motherfucking show.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say it that way, but I mean, we're not going to, right? Because it's not going to be a good conversation. Right. It's not because I have, oh my God, it's such decision-making power. It's more just like everyone knows it'd be crappy, right? Everyone we have on the show are people I'm legit really fond of and mm-hmm. want to see get better and try to hopefully support to get better and put you in good position. So when it happens, you're psyched, right?
How many players' careers started on the jump, though?
We got some
people. Oh man, it's a couple of us.
Also, I'm a little bit of a stalker when it comes to that shit. So, like, guys I know would be a good fit for us, like in the last month or two of whatever the end of what they've already said is going to be the end of their career.
Yeah.
I mean, I have followed Vince Carter personally around more arenas where he's like, Rachel, I know. And I'm like, I know, but just want to remind you.
You'll be good.
You'll be mm-hmm. coming on with us mm-hmm. after this. And he used to come on with us. You remember, mm-hmm. he used to come on with us sometimes in the playoffs when his teams didn't make it. And I would just be like, all right, well, you know what's happening when you retire, but you get nervous. Maybe they'll go somewhere else. Maybe they'll do something else. So mm-hmm. I call it light stalking. It's a light stalking.
It's not tampering on this side. McGrady was drawn in because of your knowledge of the game and couldn't turn you down. How did that feel hearing that?
Well, again, T-Mac, some light stalking. His wife helped me out with that. Like, it's good. I think there have been guys who have come in, and I don't know if T-Mac was like this. I mean, guys I've covered, I think it helps, right? So y'all dealt with me when you were playing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it helps that you feel
easier.
Tracy, you mm-hmm. just feel like you know me. So it's not like a big sell or anything. But I think there's still like a little bit of, and this is earned, by the way, why is she talking when I'm the one who played, right? Mm-hmm. I think there's a little bit of that with not anyone in particular, but with some just overall.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to, again, it's like everything else. You got to earn it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see sometimes when that flip comes for some of the guys when they're newer on the show.
Mm-hmm. Like, oh, shit, she knows what she's talking about.
Sort of, oh, okay. You know, that's right.
She's in the big seat for a reason.
Yeah, right? She's the main one.
That feels good to answer that question, whether it was with Mac or with anyone else. That feels good because the opinion of you guys really matters to me. Mm-hmm. If y'all think that we know the game and we know what we're talking about on the show, like that matters. And I think one of the great early things about the show, and you mentioned our 5 years, and it's been awesome. And honestly, we had a 6-month tryout with the show. So the fact that it turned into five years is pretty killer.
Yep.
You know, it went from a half hour to an hour. It went from just in the season to year round. Like, all that stuff made it feel really good. What meant more to me, and you guys worked with the great Gina, and so you know, and mm-hmm. she can vouch for this, was...
Shout out Gina.
Gina. GB.
Mm-hmm. When we had guys around the league say, I watch that every day.
That's the show, right?
Or I have, you know, coaches, head coaches who will text me during after discussion.
During the show.
And it's not usually to say that was wrong in a nice way. It's usually to chime in or be like, oh, you should tell him such and such. Or like, oh, you're right about that or whatever. And that to me is kind of more important, frankly, than any rating or anything else. It sort of feels like
the appreciation
I'm doing right
of
by
your
you
peers.
Guys. Well, just if I'm doing right by you guys, then mm-hmm. that means that we're doing it right.
Absolutely.
You know?
Take us back to last year, going into the bubble and really kind of being the voice of everything that went on there. You know, Jack is leading the biggest, you know, demonstration in the history of our country. The NBA decides to play. You get thrown in the bubble and you're kind of the sole person kind of keeping us in touch on what's really going on in there.
Yeah, we were the only daily show in the bubble. It was all the challenges you'd expect because you had a limited number of people who could even do stuff. So we're sitting around, we got, how many cameras you got pointed at you right now to do this show, this fine endeavor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is there another one up there?
Yeah.
We have like one producer with one camera, right. You know, and then helped by a second producer with a second camera.
Really?
What these producers did, we had two or three in the bubble at a time, depending, like people came in and out. I can't even speak to the acrobatics they had to do for us to put on a television show. So just to get to that was crazy because, again, there's just a limited number of people the NBA wanted in there, which I get, considering every one person, extra person is one more risk. And then to try to be in this crazy environment where we're living in the same place as the players, which is kind of nuts, and trying to sort of keep the right boundaries in terms of COVID and all of that. You had to be 6 feet away from people. But you have a conversation with a guy after a game. You want to talk to him.
Right.
Right? So can you do that from 8 feet away? Can you, you don't want to shout this shit. So like trying to like stay within the rules, but also do our job was kind of a whole thing. And it just, it was crazy. And then of course, because it was such an unusual situation with coronavirus and everything going on in the country leading up to this huge election, I mean, you kind of couldn't have a crazier confluence of events. And I always say about you guys that, that the NBA and the WNBA as a whole are, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, these are the most visible African-American men and women in this country, right?
No question.
And therefore, unfairly at times, there is a responsibility and a mantle of having to answer for stuff that, like, I mean, we say it all the time, people being oppressed should not have to answer for that oppression.
Yeah.
It is insane the way that mechanic works. But if you don't talk about it, who else is fucking talking about it?
Right.
So it's a catch-22, and it put all this weight on these men and women in these two bubbles, and they did it. I mean, they kept the conversation where it should be. When it was time to stop, they stopped. When it was time to start, because they had people's attention, they started. And they managed a lot of really complex, nuanced stuff in a way that, frankly, like, I was so proud every day to be associated with this group of people. Because it was hard.
Yes. Take us back to when the Milwaukee Bucks decided to sit out a game.
Well, it was so interesting to me that sort of how it happened. Because there was this idea when it first happened, like, oh, they planned this. What do they want? They didn't plan it. And they, by the way, shouldn't have had to have planned it. It was real. That was a legit in-the-moment reaction to, okay, we have found our breaking point. This is too much. It is too much. And I'm going to sit down in my place and not be moved because it is too much. And I think getting people to understand that and getting to understand then in the 48 hours that followed, like people kept saying, well, what do they want to start playing again? It's not about that. What we want, by the way, is like
stop
people to stop
people.
Killing people in the street. I don't think that's happening in the next 2 days, unfortunately.
Right.
But like, I think there was a real misunderstanding at the beginning of kind of how it happened, the domino, and even within the bubble, there was some, you know, back and forth between some of the players, right? Look, you had another team that was warming up on the court at the time, and they had some feelings, right? They were just sort of like, why didn't
told
you
us.
Tell us about this? Because now we look like we don't support Jacob Blake and his family, or that like we at least could have done this as a united front or whatever.
Right.
And I think over time, you know, over those 24 or 48 hours, it came to be an understanding of like, oh, okay, this wasn't planned and we excluded you. It's just like in that moment,
we
could not open the door and walk out of it. There were other players who felt like they were kind of put in a position like once the Bucks don't play, nobody can really play, right? You can't sit there and be like, oh, we're going to go out and play because you're not being supportive. So I think there were some other players that felt like kind of okay. And that tapped into, too, a moment in the bubble where guys had been there long enough where you just get, I mean, I know, I get it. I hear all the criticism. Oh, millionaires sitting in a fancy hotel in Florida, whatever. It is hard when you cannot leave less than 1 square mile of land. Like, I would walk, you walk in a circle, walk back in a circle. If you're a runner, you're literally running in a half semicircle you're allowed to run in, and then back, you'd have to do like 20 or 30 of those just to get a run in. Like, you cannot leave the same four walls. It is not your home. You are not with your family. And, you know, you guys have Paul George on. I thought what he said in the middle of the bubble about just sort of that mental health aspect of normally you can take a step away from the game and just, you know, have
decompress.
Your kids crawl all over you for 2 hours and like watch a stupid movie or do whatever. There's just none of that. So whatever was happening on the court is 100% of your existence. And then everything going on outside in the outside world. And I think those two things kind of conspired in that moment for the stoppage. And it just took a minute for everyone to kind of get their breath. But I also think there was a lot accomplished with that, with sort of that refocus on voting and sort of even in Wisconsin, the focus on the laws about policing and sort of what people were allowed to do. And there was legislation that was already in the state government that just wasn't getting moved along. And the players helped shine a light on that. I don't think you can look at that as anything but a triumphant moment for the league and the players in terms of, again, crazy fucking situation and rising to the occasion in a way that no, it wouldn't be fair to expect, but it's pretty awesome that it happened.
Great, they did. And that was one thing, you know, Jack and I went back and forth on, because we literally stood, and normally we 9 out of 10 times we're going to agree with each other, but we didn't agree from a standpoint of he thought that they shouldn't play, they should sit out and make their protests. And I thought the opposite. I thought there was no... there's no bigger way to get their message out than to have that NBA logo behind everyone's voice.
Have you guys, has either one changed or shifted the position at
we
all?
Talked about, you know, we talked about it on the show. We came into an understanding, and I understand his point of view. He understood my point of view. You know what I mean? But my thing was just like, you're going to hear LeBron, you're going to hear the big names, but do you hear the George Hills? Do you hear Doc's plea? Do you hear, you know, some of the people that aren't superstars, but still had amazing things to say? And like I said, individually, we're very famous, but together we're, you know, our voice travels around the world.
And I would be naive to say that it didn't make a difference. It made a huge difference, you know, but me being so into it, it was hard for me to see that far ahead. You know what I mean?
But everyone played their part because your shit was needed. Like I said,
I was going to say, you move that, people meet in the middle ground. Well, there's got to be people moving that middle ground to one side or the other. So if you're not moving that middle ground to one side or the other, then the middle's further on the other side. I do think one thing that we saw the beginning of with sort of the vote stuff from the players for the second half of the bubble that I hope continues as we go through, because there's another election that's coming. What, 18 months away, all that stuff. Is the messaging getting out that it's not just voting for president? And you and I talked about this on the air, off the air a bunch. Most of what affects our lives
is local,
right? Mm-hmm. It's who's running the school board, who's running the police force, what resources are going where the food is coming to who, like all of that stuff, what businesses are zoned for what part of town, because there's been all kinds of, you know, as you know, all kinds of redistricting, all kinds of, oh no, that's a this kind of zone, that's a this kind of zone. Yeah. I wonder what neighborhood you put those zones in. That's just such a crazy coincidence.
So random.
And I think some of the players' messaging on that, because I heard players talking about it, is the first time I have heard sort of at a national level people that all these kids and communities look up to talking about that.
Right.
And I think that's a real key.
You got to see it and hear it to believe it. You've personally been someone who has kind of stepped out on a limb considering, you know, your platform at ESPN, but talked about other issues outside of sports. And I mean, obviously we're talking about social justice now, but, you know, having friends of the program, Carrie and Jamil were very outspoken, you know, and sometimes ran into some trouble. You've been on you right there as well and talking about stuff outside of sports but affects us as players still in our communities and who we, you know, where we came from. So where did that courage come from? Because like I said, ESPN hasn't always been as lenient as they are now, and I think you've kind of helped change that narrative.
Well, it's two things, right? We all know the older you get, the more you're just comfortable with who you are and what you think, right? So there's some of that. I also really in my heart believe that a lot of these issues are not political. I understand that there are people who want to make them political, but a lot of this stuff is human rights issues, that should be okay to talk about. It's not about one side or the other. We can differ politically on how we want to solve these problems. It can't be political to just acknowledge that these fucking problems exist. So since I think that is the case, I don't feel like I'm stepping out politically. Right. I feel I am talking about things that are just real, and then we can argue over the politics of how to fix them. There's an interesting interview with Barack Obama after Donald Trump was elected, and I think it was I'm gonna get this wrong, it was the New York Times, it was New Yorker, it was someone, it was Barack's Obama's first big interview after Hillary Clinton lost and turning over the White House to Donald Trump. And he said, the thing that frustrates me the most is it used to be like, hey, global warming's happening or the environment, you know, we got to address this. And there was a lot of fighting over the EPA and like how we would solve the problem that there was smog in all these cities and that like our air and water was getting polluted and it was poisoning children and that we had like nuclear reactor pollution and all that. There was a lot of argument over how to fix that. There was an argument about the fact it needed to be fixed. Mm. And he pointed out that now there's an argument about whether the problem even exists at all. So for me, like that has been something that I don't feel like I'm stepping out on a limb too much because to me, I actually believe it is not political. Right. And then some of it comes too of you sit there and you play it out. And I'm like, great. I have this sentence in my head always of like, okay, what's the newspaper headline if I get suspended? Rachel Nichols suspended from ESPN 4. Mm. And then it's like, okay, I'm okay.
I'm good with that. Right.
Right. So I really came out hard when the NBA was considering or had its All-Star game scheduled for Charlotte. And there were some laws passed in Charlotte that I just felt were serious civil rights issues. I mean, this was lunch counters. Mm-hmm. I know that there is, again, politics. There was a side of the issue that tried to or dubbed it the bathroom bill or the bathroom law. That was not the heart of the law. The heart of the law was that businesses, including restaurants, including hotels, hospitality,
unbelievable,
could turn someone away for being gay. And they were going to hold an all-star game with an openly gay president of a team, the Golden State Warriors, who was the reigning dynasty at the time, mm-hmm, who could have come to town and been told, I'm sorry, you can't stay at the team hotel because we have this law now. Like, that's not okay. And I remember it was kind of early in the jump and talking to one of the executive producer, Kevin Wilds, who worked with us on the show then, and he was so great at being supportive. And I just kind of felt like, okay, I'm going to really go out here. And if someone calls me and says, I'm sorry, I'm taking you off the air for a week, I'm okay with that headline.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that's kind of where...
For the right reason. I mean, we were just together. We broke, because it came across the wire as we were working, the All-Star, the MLB deciding to move the All-Star game out of Atlanta. You know, and I think it's great that sports is kind of... Because it's always a touchy subject, and people are scared to talk about human rights, but at the end of the day, racism. You know what I mean? So it's always very touching. Like you said, they'll turn it into political talk, but at the end of the day, it's basic human rights.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's beautiful that you're starting to see, especially MLB, that's America's pastime.
I was going to say.
You know what I mean? For them to take a step and say, hey, you know, what you're doing in Georgia is not right. We're going to move our business. Like, to me, it's just like, I kind of feel like a change is amongst us.
I thought that the MLB did that. You and I were talking before the show that Delta is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
These are not businesses, as you say, that are so traditionally in support of some of the stuff that the NBA, let's say, or the even the NFL players are, have been in support of. And they really stepped out there and did it. And it is fascinating to me again. And it, you know, look, voting laws are more political by their nature. But it's crazy to me that people who in one hand are waving an American flag are trying to limit what makes America America, which is democracy. It's just sort of how do we get here?
Unbelievable.
And it's a shame that we have to use the word courageous when talking about someone coming out against that limitation of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it is now, and I'm psyched that we're seeing people do it.
Do it. How do you see the progression of sports journalism when it pertains to women compared to where you first came in?
So definitely the couple generations before me were the ones that had like the really shitty time. And I mean, there's a story about a woman who was the baseball beat writer for a long time, and she's amazing and worked her ass off. And baseball is a tough place to be breaking into. And we're talking 30, 40 years ago. And one of the players kept saying, she's like a little rat in the locker room. And then they sent her a fucking rat in a box to open.
Ooh.
Like, there's all the stories about, you know, guys inappropriate, doing things, saying things in locker rooms, all that shit. So the women before me had to deal with the brunt of that. By the time I came in, it was not that bad. It was certainly not as good as it is now, which is, you know, it's nice that we're seeing progress. I don't think we had women hosting sports shows in the same way we do now. I mean, I have to go back and look. If someone was doing it, I don't want to not give light on their legacy. But in general, it was not the thing that we saw. So being able to make that progress feels good. I think now the line is, and I think it's the same thing with race, I see my friends deal with, is the criticisms aren't overtly about race or gender, but you know that the standard's different, right? You know that like they're picking at the black guys, they're picking at the women, they're especially picking at women of color in a way that they just aren't doing with some of the people that they are, quote, more used to or more mm-hmm. comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the next hurdle, because in some ways that's more insidious. It's harder to fight against. Like, if I've had times where earlier in my career, I've had people say, you can't go to the post-game locker room. You can't go to the press conference. And I will say to that security guard, well, here's my credential. You know, I always have to have my, even now, I always have to be the one to have my credential. It's mm-hmm. not enough that I'm mm-hmm. wanting to run around. Have my credential. Here I am. And I have had more than one guy, I had a guy say to me one time in a hallway, oh, I'm sorry, honey, the anthem singer can't be back here. Or even like people, you know, show them a credential with the name ESPN or before that with the Washington Post and say, oh, I'm look at you. You can't go where the boys are, but boys are changing in there. And you're just like, that's not how this is set
anthem
up.
Singer.
So that stuff is in some ways easier to deal with and battle against, because you just get the right person in the right place and you just deal with it, right? It's the more sort of the little chipping away. And you mentioned Carrie or Jamel earlier. Jamel is a great example. All kinds of criticisms of her that weren't overtly about her being a woman or overtly about race, but come on, mm-hmm. we know why they're picking on her. Mm-hmm. Kamala Harris in the debate, she's shrill. She's making faces. That's all code
right.
for we don't want a black woman up there.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think that's the thing that the women in my industry are sort of now that's a level we're fighting against, mm-hmm. but that's true for everyone, you know?
Yeah.
How do you feel of being in the spotlight and being an example for young women that want to be in this space? How do you feel like being the standard and the blueprint?
Well, I mean, I hope that I can be a good example when I'm, you know, every day when I'm out there.
Along with others like Doris Burke and others.
I was going to say, there's so many. That's kind of the second half of that sentence. Is we're lucky. There's so many women just at ESPN, but even across the board. So no one has to carry that weight on their own. And that is a relief. And as I say, different from the women who were maybe a generation before me, where a lot of them, they were not the only one in the room sometimes. They were the only woman in the room all the time.
Yeah.
And now I'm still the only woman in the room sometimes, but it's not all the time. And that makes a huge difference. But I hope that I can show people and young women that they have the room to succeed, but also the room to screw up.
Okay.
Again, it's why every time on the jump when we do stupid shit, I'll be like, oh God, this fell apart. That's not the video that's supposed to run now. I should have said that. I say this is what I meant to say or whatever. Because I do think when you are a minority in the space, whether it is race or gender or whatever it is, you feel like you have to be perfect.
Right.
And there's that pressure on you to be perfect because you're representing everyone. And if you mess it up, I remember really clearly when I was covering more NFL for ESPN, I was the reporter on site at some football game. And the guys at NFL Live or Countdown or whoever it was were talking. And Michael Irvin kept talking about Al Gore. Al Gore, Al Gore, Al Gore. And it just didn't, I was like, no, Frank Gore. Frank Gore is who he was talking about. But he just kept slipping and saying the wrong name. And it was fine. I mean,
that's
it was legitimately fine.
That's funny,
though. It was funny. It was fine. It was totally fine. If I do remember, though, being listening with my IFB, waiting for my turn to talk, and thinking, if I said that,
mm-hmm.
I would be probably done. I was still young enough and new enough that, like, you know, whatever. So you do feel that pressure of I have to be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And I am so far from perfect that I hope that kind of gives a little people some room. And also, like, I do impress upon young women all the time and young men, people who come to me for advice, like, you just got to fucking do the work. Mm-hmm. It's not going to just be there for you.
What's the chances mm-hmm. of Michael Irvin saying Al Gore? Do you get the connection? I do. Do you? Another show.
What are your thoughts on this current NBA season? Obviously, the pandemic hit last year. We go into a bubble. You experienced that. Short off mm-hmm. season, late start, all-star game. What is your thought just on covering the basketball for a long enough time just to kind of see where the NBA is right now?
Well, there's so much stuff going on right now that's historic, right? Quote, unquote. We never had a season like this. We never had a bubble like this. We never had a 72-game season before. I don't know what it's going to look like in the playoffs. You know, we never had COVID tests before or a pandemic or any of this
20-0.
Shit. So, exactly.
28-1. With the one is a no contest.
Yeah, no contest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No contest. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been paying attention, by the way, when you guys have been given these stats. And I just want to point out, Stacks winning. So, mm-hmm. there you go.
Undefeated, baby.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Surprising with that nose. I'm surprised anything can get up in that motherfucker. I'm surprised nothing.
They probably lost a couple Q-tips up there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can get that mascot all over everything. So that feels special, right? Mm-hmm. To be doing something that's never happened before. But I'm also, and we talked about this a little bit, I want Stack's take. So every day I say out of my mouth at some point during the show these days is, hey, that's a new NBA record, or that's a rookie record, or that's a such and such record. We have had, because of a lot of just different conspiring events, like this huge scoring inflation over the last couple years, mm-hmm. to the point where look, whatever day this airs and you guys look it up on your stats, just excuse me if this has changed by 1.20 degrees. But as I sit here, 9 of the top 10, like, highest producing, most efficient offenses have been offenses in the last 2 years in the history of the NBA. Does that mean that we've had suddenly, like, the second coming of the best NBA players ever in this last two seasons? No. It just means the teams aren't playing defense the same way. The rules are different. The pandemic changes everything. You don't have practice time, so therefore you can't, like, play solid defense, all that shit.
Right.
So part of what I'm trying to navigate right now in this unprecedented season is, how do I talk about this?
Yeah.
Right? Because we talk about, oh, this guy, I don't know, I think it was Anthony Edwards, who, like, had a record the other night where he has more points as a rookie than anyone but LeBron and KD. And I'm like, well, does that mean that he's in the LeBron and KD conversation, or does it just mean that there's more points available right now?
Right.
I don't know how to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, what's your take on it?
I would say he has the upside to be in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
He's headed in that direction. That's all I could say. I wouldn't put him in that.
But overall, with inflated numbers, because I mean, when we talked to Webb the other day and he didn't say it, but Webb would kill in this era.
You know, right. Like, but you got the players now saying the game is softer.
Yep.
Yeah.
So when we say it, we being disrespectful, we hate. But when the players today that's actually playing say the game is soft, you know, they agree with it. But the game is definitely, it's a scoring game now, point blank.
Mm-hmm. I mean, would you agree with scoring is what continues to help the game grow?
Well, I do think that, like, look, people, it brings kids in. I have, like, we're the twin club. You had C-Webb on the other day. He's in the twin club. Yep. So, you know, you are a twin in so many ways, Jack.
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
Great. if not biologically, then, you know, in spirit.
Yes.
It's funny. I have young twins. We moved here when they were like 4.5, and it was in the height of Warriors mania. And their mommy had the games on at night all the time, and we had West Coast timing, right? Mm-hmm. So we had Steph Curry and whatever. And my kids fell in love with Steph at 5 years old. These two little girls, like, and Clay and the whole nine. And my daughter would say, "Oh, Steph's just like me. He's small." And I'd say, "No, you're 4." And he's actually 6'2", but to her, she felt like that. My other daughter loves Draymond. Mm-hmm. She just thinks he's the best, and she wants to play, when on her basketball team, she wants to play defense like Draymond.
I love it.
And all of that. And I watched that team bring them in a way, if they had maybe been little kids in the era where I was covering you, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
If in an 84 to 87 Pacers Spurs game, they would have, like, really attached to the game in that same way. So I do think it helps. I've watched it happen to my own house. I don't know how your twins are with all that.
Same thing. I mean, I think, like I said, I think it comes to a point, and if you even talk about it from, like, what we do, I would much rather talk about highlight scoring than a defense. You know what I mean? Like, because I know that's what, as a purist, I wouldn't mind talking about. But I know the crowd or our fans want to see 3-point. They want to see Steph shooting from half, Dame shooting from half. They want to see LeBron dunking. Like, that's what they want to see. Oh. They don't want to see that old school battle.
I mean, when Dame pulls up, it's great.
Oh, incredible. Beautiful.
There's no arguing about that.
Incredible.
But, you know. Exactly.
Go ahead.
Bye-bye.
Who has impressed you most, team and players?
You know what I'm impressed by? I mean, this is a little cop-out answer, but it's just the truth. Like, the under-25 crowd in the NBA right now are so fucking together.
Yes.
Like, the Donovan Mitchells of the world and, like, all that stuff. Like, self-possessed and, like, understanding the game, and I don't even mean basketball, I mean, like, the big game, better than certainly I did at that age, but I think even the past generations did, and they have the benefit, right? They've grown up with social media. They've grown up with, like, a more global, kind of perspective. They've grown up with more new ideas, like, at them earlier, so they've been able to internalize that shit. But, like, I've been constantly kind of surprised at, like, wait, this kid's 23?
Right.
Like, this kid's 24? And just sort of the possession, self-possession, and sort of the way that they have been able to both try, it's still, a lot of those guys are still trying to make their name in the game, but not afraid to put themselves, their brand, their, you know, everything on the line for what's important. And that's kind of really That stuck with me.
I think
a
lot. It's a different way from when we came in. I mean, even what the conversations that happened, like the business of basketball was never even a cross thought when we first came in. It's chains, it's cars, it's women, it's this material things. But now the whole narrative has changed. It's what are you investing in? Are you in Bitcoin? Are you in this? Are you in that? What social justice issue are you standing behind? And like you said, guys aren't afraid to put there, because I mean, back when we started, that's brand suicide. You know what I mean? You stand, if Jack stands up for what he stood up for Georgie back in the day, who knows what would have happened. You know what I mean? So it's just a different time, obviously.
Well, the money's changed, right?
That's true.
So you're not as dependent on that NBA specific paycheck in the same way. You've gotten the money you've already made in your career, which is more earlier, so you can risk a little more earlier. Your brand paycheck from your shoes, from your sponsors, stuff like that is different and bigger, so you can step out. And brands and sponsors have changed, because they now have to answer to a more educated consumer base that cares about this stuff.
Right.
I love the guys at Nike. I don't know if they would have stood behind Colin Kaepernick 20 years ago, but they knew when they did it in the last few years, not only was it in terms of the belief system of the people who work there, it was also a good business decision.
Right.
So that all has changed a little bit too. So I got a question for you guys about basketball. I mentioned this to you the other day. If I'm stepping out, we don't have to talk about it.
No.
But I've been like super trying to figure this out. So we've been talking about James Harden, right? And quote, forcing his way out of Houston. What do you guys think is the right move for players who are in a system where they get drafted, right? Because the way America, this is not the NBA, American professional sports work this way, right? They work this way overseas too. You get drafted. It's a monopoly and they get to tell you where they go. You don't, you know, just go and say, oh, I'd like to live in Chicago. You're under these contracts where they literally use the words in front offices like, oh, we have control of that player's contract, or we are control that player for X number of years, or that kind of thing. And it's written into the system that you sign a contract, but the other side signs too for X number of years. And then they can turn around within a certain number of months and trade you. Your kids don't go to that school anymore. Like they shift your life. And that mechanism is not set up for players. And I don't actually know the answer, because there can't be an NBA if everybody can just pick where they start out to go. Because frankly, like there's a lot of, like Jack, you probably wouldn't have picked the Pacers.
Went straight to the Rockets.
Right. But it turned out, you know, like I
had been to Harlem Nights every night.
But you had great success there. You know what I mean? Like we can't just sort of, I get why the system isn't set up to just have, everybody has free choice
will,
all the time. But what do you do? Because you have a thing this year, and this came from our discussion about James Harden. We've been talking about like, okay, is he going to get quote penalized by MVP voters because of what happened in Houston at the beginning of the year? And I just don't know what a player is supposed to do. What do you guys think a player should do?
Young Malcolm.
I think for the most part, James did what he don't think he could do. And because like when teams feel like you have no more value, they put you at the end of the bench. They demean you. It might not be in the media, but they have their little own fraternity of owners and managers where they talk behind closed doors. And if they both agree that you not any good no more, they'll put you at the end of the bench like they tried to do Melo. So my whole thing with James was I just felt like, you know, when you have a black coach like Steve Silas getting a shot, help him look good. But at the same time, I understand James too wanting to win. And if they not going to move him, then he has to force his way out. Because the same way he can force his way out, they can make him look bad to force him to stay there. So it's a tough situation, but the same way the teams can make you look bad, you should be able to way to make yourself look good and speak on getting yourself out of there.
But how do you do that without getting a label? Because that's what we were talking about. Like, is James wrong for wanting to get out?
He's not wrong, but it's going to be opinions either way, because you're going to have fans that say, we've been loyal to this whole time. But then there's going to be players like us that understand, hey, he want to win. He don't want to finish his career like Charles Barkley. He want to be in a position to win a championship. So we understand it, but it's always the fans that's in their feelings that's been like, well, you should stay with us. You owe us this. And really, he don't owe you anything.
Well, then we're asking too. I mean, because to me, if we're talking about basketball with LeBron getting hurt and Embiid getting hurt, Harden, to me, if it's not Joker, it's Harden to win the MVP. But we are talking about, well, will some voters hold it against Harden, his issues he had getting out of Houston?
I wouldn't say that, because how does that affect what he's doing on the court? he went there and immediately made an impact.
Huge.
He's playing
impact.
Basketball.
Mm-hmm. And to Great me, basketball.
And I have to go against y'all. I would say he is the MVP, him and Kyrie. I would give him co-MVP because what they've been able to do immediately, most teams, when you bring in stars like that, it take a year or two. Mm-hmm. Then it even happens where one of the stars have to go because they didn't work out, you know? So the way they've been able to gel and bring all this together, you got to give all the credit to James, bro. You have to, and I don't think him getting asking to leave should be a knock on anything he's able to do this season.
I agree. No, I thought Harden was, you know, to me, he's definitely worked his way to the top of the MVP conversation.
But to me, it's not as, like, yes, I think, and that MVP conversation, by the way, is going to keep going, and right. We still mm-hmm. have a third of the season, and mm-hmm. I always say, that, like, how am I supposed to make a decision now? Like, if you had asked me a month ago, I didn't know LeBron was going to get hurt, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know Embiid was going to get hurt, so, like, how would I have, like, if I had come out and said, this is who I'm voting for, like, I would have looked like an idiot, because I wouldn't have known right. that Joel Embiid was going to end up, you know, hurt or whatever. So I'm not making an MVP case for anyone at the moment,
right?
But it has brought up to me sort of one of these new frontiers of discussion with the NBA of what do we owe each other in terms of these contracts? What are the players, like, what vehicles do they have? Like, I think player empowerment as an expression has been a little overused at this point,
mm-hmm.
but like, where is the line and what is fair, but also creates a functioning NBA? Because
right.
it is the business that mm-hmm. everybody makes money off of. And if the league collapsed, that would be a problem too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's kind of figuring out where that middle ground is mm-hmm. and James's situation, no matter which side of the argument you fall on, whether somebody comes out in this final third and Nikola Jokic is on fire and he's clearly the MVP, doesn't really matter to this conversation. I just more mean like, it's interesting to me because mm-hmm. it's sort of the one place where we've accepted free agency and moving around in a way we didn't used to in the league, and like that idea of loyalty kind of doesn't isn't used to shame players anymore, which is really what it was for
right.
at sometimes. But that one frontier is something where I don't know what the answer is, and I'm kind of curious the question is brought up.
Being a voter mm-hmm. yourself, and we've discussed this on yeah. the show as well, what is it going to take to see the whole, instead of just being a regular season MVP, mm-hmm. just a whole body MVP?
Yep.
Because obviously Giannis is back to back and he's struggled in the playoffs and hasn't been able to get his team to that next level. And when I picture MVPs, I'm picturing at the end of the game, it's the guy you can go to get your team a win.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there's obviously, and I'm not the only one that thinks like that, but you know, you as a voter, you know, Matt, we understand that, but it's the regular season. What would it take, or why doesn't it look at the whole entire season?
So that one of my big things over the years with the show, and the poor guys in the NBA office have heard this from me way too often, award reform, right? That's what I keep saying. We need some award reform because the NBA has not made any kind of major change to its awards in so many years, and every other American pro sports league, the major ones, have all since then. So the NBA, which is usually so far ahead of the other leagues, just isn't in this category. And I get the tradition and all of that. And then when you make a change, it then affects the value, quote unquote, of other people's MVPs or things in the past. But I just think the league has been so great about it. If something isn't right, like, let's not worry about how it looks. Let's just fix it. And something that's not right to me is like most valuable player is not what we're really awarding right now. What we're really awarding is who's had the best statistical regular season.
Mm-hmm.
That's how that award has been sort of litigated and voted on. And partly that's the directive we get from the mm-hmm. NBA. It's only regular season. Here's the stats. It's partly what stats are available to us, right? It used to be just kind of basic stats and offense and defense. Now we've got like hardcore offensive stats. We got a little less defensive stats. We got no stats for leadership. Mm. We got no stats for what someone says in the huddle or the judgment someone makes in like
right.
a key moment or decision. We've got clutch stats, but those don't always tell the whole story or mm-hmm. anything. So because those statistics have taken on a greater part of how people analyze the game, and because the voters are being told it's only regular season, the MVP at the moment is who had the best statistical regular season. That is what we would call it. It's clunky, but that is what it actually is. I'd like to see the MVP be for the MVP. Who's the fucking most valuable guy on this team,
right,
in this league?
Right.
We all know who it is every
mm-hmm.
year.
Right.
And sometimes it's debatable. Like, there was a point where it looked like KD was going to wrest that away from
right.
LeBron, right? And then he gets hurt. Like that can be a really interesting
mm-hmm.
discussion. It's not always the same guy all the time,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, there's a time where Kobe and MJ, like you've had these changing the guard moments that could be fascinating if
mm-hmm.
we gave an award for this.
Right.
And it would also identify, it's that I think Bill Simmons made the point, like, if the aliens came down and you had to win one basketball game and pick one guy to lead your team.
The guy in Space Jam, probably,
know,
right?
Exactly. We all know who it is. Well, I mean, originally that guy in Space Jam was
right.
Michael Jordan,
straight
right?
Straight up.
Well,
both
Michael
of
Jordan should have won more MVPs.
Kobe should have
right?
won more.
Like,
LeBron
should
have won more.
I just think that eye test or whatever you want to call it, who is legit the most valuable guy in the league? Mm-hmm. The problem is the awards aren't set up right. And right. So it puts voters like me in kind of a crappy position. I know who the best guy in the league is, but I look at his numbers and during the regular season for reasons that could be that as some of these guys age, it's not smart for them to go all out in the regular season. They would be doing their team a disservice if they chase stats in the regular season. But because of that,
They're penalized
in voting. And even me as a voter, I have to say, okay, well, like, that's not what I'm being asked to vote on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I would love to see us as an NBA, as a league, follow what the NFL does, follow what the Major League Baseball does. They give awards, the NHL, they give awards for scoring. They give awards for like best offensive player or best season or something like that. And it differs in every league, but you know the difference.
Right.
And there are so many years where a guy like Giannis could have won best season, but someone else, until he proved that he could be the guy to lead his team to a championship,
can't be the MVP.
Someone else is the MVP.
Yeah, it's hard to be MVP and you're shooting eyeballs from the free throw line, fam.
Well,
I'm talking about.
He doesn't love being MVP. He doesn't. He wants to win. He right. knows that
the bigger goal for him is the champion. Yeah, getting his team over the hump.
Right, Steven, don't you think?
Yeah, but you can't be shooting eyeballs at the free throw line, fam. That's all I'm saying.
He has a big issue with that.
It's just hard for me to say you the best player in the league and you shooting oxygen from the line. We asked Kobe that, what he said. I've never done it with my left hand. Come on, man. All right.
You've been a part along the ride for LeBron's journey from the beginning.
Yeah.
From high school to... Yep. Where he's at, just winning this past championship, the highs, the lows. What have you seen the most as maturity goes on and off the court?
Well, it's cool, first of all, to have a front row seat to someone's life. From I met LeBron when he was a senior in high school. We could be talking about someone who's a plumber. If I met someone when they were a senior in high school and then all the way through age 36 had this front row seat and being able to be there when they did the thing they were doing and watch them as they had kids or had family or... like sort of had a social justice sort of figuring out how they could do that, you know, grew in terms of he started goddamn school. Like, I mean, the whole thing, that could be anyone. It would have been a fascinating thing. And the fact that it was someone who has done all of this stuff, these extraordinary things, has been a cool thing for me. And I did start in Chicago watching Michael Wilbon do that with Michael Jordan, right? And kind of tagging along to a lot of the stuff. And then, you know, I happened to work in Washington, D.C. when Jordan came to Washington, D.C. and Michael Wilbon was obviously working with me then. So again, got to tag along to a lot of sort of that experience, watching someone else do it, having that front row seat and getting to have done that with LeBron. And then in turn, as the younger guys come in, starting to have that with them too has been really cool. I mean, as someone whose job it is to sort of interpret what I see and kind of create these stories, you couldn't ask for anything more than that. It's been pretty awesome.
Thoughts on how the league and Adam Silver has handled the last year's past events?
I mean, look, I don't think you can argue, like, it's been an overall, like, huge success, right? The fact that they got a league playing and they were able to navigate through a global pandemic and keep everyone safe and nobody has had, you know, knock on every surface near me because we're not out of this yet.
Right.
But no one has had serious health problems while you are trying to move people around the country in groups on a contact sport where everyone sweats all over each other. That is no easy thing. Have there been little things along the way that
always
they
is.
May have wanted to do better? You know, now that hindsight's 2020, they would tell you that,
right.
you know? So sure. But, you know, it's kind of like I say, like, no one's perfect.
Right.
People, you just got to do the best that you can. And I think they've made really good choices a lot of the time.
I agree.
Thoughts on the play-in format? Because I absolutely love it.
I love it, too. I know a lot of people don't, but I think it's awesome. It was really fun in the bubble.
Right.
And it just gives everybody a little bit more skin in the game, but in a way that doesn't feel like it's going to mess with the integrity of who wins. Like, I don't think it's going to make it. The play-in tournament is going to have no effect on who wins the NBA title. Mm-hmm. I don't think whoever makes it into the playoff game is going to win. We've never had an 8 seed win a title before. Came close a little bit with Patrick Ewing, but never. Didn't happen. And I certainly don't think a play-in team is my guess. I mean, who knows? Someone's now going to do it, and they're going to show this clip.
I'm looking in the camera. I doubted you,
who I don't even know, and I don't even know what team this is, but clearly I doubted you, and you can use that as motivation.
I mean, if the Lakers slide, you know, with AD and Braun, if they happen to slide, like, to me, if they slide and get into a play-in situation, as long as they're healthy, I still think they're the best team in the Western, you know, outside of them.
Yes.
I agree.
No, I think that's true. But that's a case of the play-in. I just don't think the play-in is going to have a team that doesn't deserve
it.
I guess that's what I should say. Because, like, in a single elimination thing, In that first game or two of the actual play-in tournament, anyone can win. But what, right. that team then has to go into the playoffs, mm-hmm. right? Then you have to go into seven-game series. Mm-hmm. So I just don't think you're going to get some outlier team that shouldn't be there
right.
win. So I should. That's a good point. I should have. See, I messed up. I should. Mm-hmm. I should put that in there.
I got you.
You got me. See,
yeah, you got me. Yeah.
But yeah, I just think that it's only fun. How do you feel about Jack?
I just feel like it's an interesting twist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like the old school way. You got to earn your way in. I don't like all this other shit. You know, top eight, everybody else go home, get on that boat early. 1, 2, 3, Cancun. And, you know, everybody else that earned it, get in there.
See, I like it because I think it starts the energy for the playoffs a little bit sooner. And
yeah.
It's a cool format. You know, seven plays eight and mm-hmm. seven. The winner gets seven.
Seven.
And then eight plays the winner of 9-10.
The loser of the 7-8 battle plays the winner of 9-10, and that's who's the eighth seed.
Yeah, so to me, I just think it's great energy. I just think it gives the playoffs a jump start. And like you said, something different. I mean, I get tradition, but like we said, I mean, we're in just a different time now, so why not try something different? And I think something that they did that worked well in the bubble,
yep.
they're continuing.
If I'm an eighth seed, I ain't finna fight for the eighth seed.
Well, it depends on who you are, too.
That's what
right?
Draymond said. Like Draymond said, don't get him excited.
Right?
I'm already here. What I got to play for?
And by the way, the Raptors, right, this year, it depends on who you are.
We've been sorry all year, Rachel, to land in this eighth spot. We don't deserve it.
Look, the Raptors this year at the trade deadline, this is a team that is 2 years removed from winning a title. Playing in a state they don't even live in.
True.
Like, not even in front of their fans, all this stuff. And they basically decided, you know what? We're going to try to keep our core, but we're not going to, like, go all out to win a playing game. We don't have to. Our fans don't expect that. They're not going to be happy with a we won a playing game.
Yeah,
we won a title
yeah.
2 years ago. Right. So for teams like that, for teams like the Warriors, I get Draymond being like, straight I'm up. Not excited. But you know what? We had De'Aaron Fox on the show the other day. He'd like to play
oh,
a
yeah,
playing game.
Yeah.
You know, and mm-hmm. I get that too. That's a good yeah. experience for him.
But yeah. even if you wouldn't be excited, even though Draymond's not excited, know when the ball goes up for you and the ball goes up for him, that you yeah. guys are going to play your asses off.
Yeah,
up.
True.
So, but I get true. Like, motherfucker, I'm playing for championships, not a playing game.
But right.
I still get it.
Who do you have in the finals?
Ooh, I don't predict, but here's why. I swear it's not just a cop out. Here's what I love about sports and what really got me when you guys were asking at the very beginning about why I, you know, how I grew up to do this is. I love superhero movies, right? I love comic book movies. I love the whole thing. I'm unusually excited to a point where people are concerned about me, about Star Wars movies or things like that. But I do know in the end who's going to win. I sit down in an Avengers movie, you know who's winning? The fucking Avengers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sit down in a Star Wars movie, I know which side is going to win. When I go to a basketball game, I don't know who Spider-Man is, and I don't know who the villain is. Mm. I gotta wait till the end to find out who the winner is, who the guy I'm supposed to be rooting for is.
Mm-hmm.
That is so essential to me about why I love this game that I fight so hard. We don't do a ton of picks on our show, as you guys both know. We do some because the players like it, but mm-hmm. like, I don't. Like, I am hoping to be surprised by who is in the finals this year because that will make it so much more
fun
for me.
So she's got Superman versus Captain America.
Exactly. I'm all in.
That's what she's got.
Superman versus Captain America. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
You recently did an interview with Juan Toscano-Anderson.
Yeah.
And he was just in awe with the fact that he got interviewed by you.
Sweet. It was a press conference. He was oh, yeah. so kind.
Right.
I was just
it,
asking him a question. He was right. like, Rachel Nichols was asking
right.
me a question. It was very sweet.
Like when you hear younger players and newer players, I mean, I think obviously it goes back to what we were saying at the beginning, like mm-hmm. it's a sign of respect. Like people
nice.
Look, respect you and look up to, but how does that make you feel without being all modest?
Well, I mean, look, again, it's just.
Yeah, I'm tired of that.
Here's the thing it makes me feel that is not modesty because it's me saying, hey, I did this, mm-hmm. is that it makes me feel like I put in
it.
The work.
You earned
right?
It.
That's
right.
what it makes me feel like. It doesn't mean, oh, man, I know everything or, oh, I'm a big deal to these guys because that goes away and you know, you guys
mm-hmm.
both know that.
So you're not going to take no
tomorrow.
Credit for me being where I'm
well,
at?
Well, yeah. For you being, no, I'm not taking any credit for you. You've done this all yourself.
Yeah, but my first opportunity was with you.
Well, because
you gave
I
me my
knew
first
how,
opportunity.
Because I knew how good you could be and I knew who you were as a person. And
so
again, that
I
goes
forever
back
give
to,
you credit for it.
Well, come on.
I love what you used to wear, though. Your flannels with your mm-hmm. gold chains hanging
oh,
out.
Yeah,
so
I was weak. I was weak. It was weak sometimes. then I came back with the suits. I got tired of y'all talking about me, so I came back with the suits.
So
I used to see, I was one of my homeboys, it might even be my brother, yo, Jack's on this new ESPN show with like a Boys in the Hood flannel
and
some jeans hanging out. So, oh, shit. I got to see what this
that
shit is.
That goes back to what we wanted the show to be at the front,
right.
which
chill.
Was... A, chill, mm-hmm. and B, like, be who you are.
Be you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Be you.
I did that.
You're good at that. You're definitely good at that. Changing speeds a little bit. You had an amazing sit down with Mac and Kobe at the Mamba Academy.
You make me cry. That's not nice.
Classic. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Talk to us just about what that interview and what you took from them, because their journeys were very similar coming up together. How special was that interview for you?
Yeah, it meant a lot to me because I had covered the thick of them competing against each other. So I knew what that I knew all the nuance of that relationship and what it was and how tight they had been at the beginning, and then how they had some separation, not because anyone did anything wrong and there was no beef, but just like as competitors and you grow apart and everything. And I knew too from covering them both or having being friendly and working with them both post career that they weren't really in touch in that close way. They were good. Again, they were totally good with each other. I don't want to even like get near implying anything else, but they just, you know, life is life, right? Yep. And I knew, I could see in the moment, the minute we brought them back together, just that all that energy was like just like back when they were like 20 years old, and it was just everything. And then what was pretty awesome after that was seeing in the year that followed, and unfortunately that's all we had. It was really less than a year before he died, but that they really got close again. Yeah. And I think it was having that sort of moment, a reason to be together, to have a 2-hour conversation. Mm-hmm. And then from that it became like, oh, hey, my kid's in this AAU tournament. Your kid, oh, let's hang out at the AAU tournament. They were rooting for each other's kids at games and shit and talking. Mm-hmm. And that felt, especially now knowing what we know about the time that Kobe had left, like that felt really nice to me that in some tiny way, like just that circumstance helped bring them again, like not because there was any beef, but just back together into in each other's circle again in a way that I think was really special. And Kobe for me, and I've talked about this, I was starting out when Kobe was starting out, and it was hard sometimes. People just, you know, I'm very short. I'm very girl. I all the stuff, and didn't want to talk to me about stuff. Didn't want me around. Didn't take me seriously. You know, all the stuff that's just, it's just harder. It's harder when you're starting. It's hard to get people to trust you. One of the early teams I covered, the captain of the team and the general manager of the team would not answer a single question of mine. They would just say, next question. Because I was the first woman to cover them. They did not want a woman beat writer. And they thought if they just didn't give me information or access that I would just fail and not do well. And then shockingly, there'd be a man next time. Mm. So that was some of the early stuff you have to deal with, or I had to deal with. And Kobe's rookie year, and you guys know this from knowing him, it was not a picnic.
Not at all.
You know, there were a lot of people who did not want him there. This kid from high school thought he could do everything that we turned out he could do, but at that point, no one knew for sure he could do. There was a lot of resistance on an older Lakers team. There was stupid stuff, like because Kobe was there and he was under 21, they couldn't have beer in the locker room anymore. I mean, just like from the little to the big, you know, and he comes in like a bull in a china shop, so all of that. So we really, that rookie year, I came out to LA to do a story on him, and it started as an interview, and we just ended up, I remember, like I can tell you exactly where we were sitting on a bench, like, you know, after long, and it's like one of those time lapses where like the end of practice ends around you and then everybody slowly leaves and like the lights didn't actually go out, but that sort of felt like, and just talking and talking about what it felt like to be the kid that nobody wanted there, and kind of had that early bond of that, and then kind of to watch what he became. And in my tiny, microscopically smaller way, what I got to become was something that was very special throughout 20 years of, again, a front row seat to his life and a bond we had and conversations we'd have. And to be able to have had that moment with him and Mac so soon, close to the end, it's not enough. It's never going to be enough, but it felt like a pretty good thing to have gotten in.
You and I mean, that's when he passed. Obviously, the coverage we did on the jump was nonstop and wasn't easy. But it was, I just found it was so cool to get everyone's different story of Kobe. You know what I mean? Because everyone had this perception, Mamba, asshole, this, and that. But if he let you in, you got to see how special he was. So to be able to hear everyone share their different Kobe story and how he affected them and realize how many people he affected. Yeah. Obviously, I didn't want it to happen. And once it did happen, I mean, I guess, you know, the way you celebrate life was being able to hear all these amazing stories from, you know, this amazing person. So that was a tough, 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 tough time. Very tough times. Mm-hmm. Tough journey.
And another example to people, by the way, that like you can grow and learn as a person.
Mm.
Like what you do in your life doesn't have to be right. the end of your story. Yeah. You can be a better person afterward.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that I would, that, you know, talk about messages from 2020.
Right.
Like no one's story ends. There's no book. There's no period at the end. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously death, but even then, you know, Kobe has lived on since then.
Right.
So you got to keep going and keep getting better every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had the honor of telling Paul Pierce and Chris Bosh they were finalists for the NBA Hall of Fame. How was that?
That was really fun. We did it first with Mac when he got into the Hall of Fame.
Yep.
Which was
you guys actually did a show from the Hall of Fame, right?
We did a show from the Hall of Fame when he was inducted. But back then, there wasn't, like now there's a little bit of a procedure where it's sort of like the finalists announce on this day. And people, even if they don't know what's coming on that day on that show, which Paul Pierce and Chris Bosh, we got to tell on the show that day, they had no idea. I had to have this whole plan with Chris's very kind wife, who was, I was like, can you get him in front of a phone where he can FaceTime at X time, but don't tell him why. And here's the, you know, that kind of thing. But with Tracy, like there was no, I mean, it was just completely, he came in one day and it was, he didn't even know he was eligible because they had changed the eligibility rules like within that year about the number of years you had to be off. So for him, it was just, it was totally, it was emotional. It was emotional to be in with that. A little less so with these guys because they kind of knew it was, again, not coming on that day, but knew it was coming in general. It feels so special though. I mean, the Hall of Fame, it's the Hall of Fame. It's just sort of that thing, and that I don't lose that ever. Like, what a big deal that is to guys.
Every interview you do is obviously different. Who is your most memorable and why?
All right, I'm going to give you like quick hit list of some ones and why, and I'm a terrible person. I'm not picking just one, but whatever. All right. I interviewed Tiger Woods in Turkey in an airplane hangar after he hit golf balls across a bridge in Istanbul that went from one continent to the other. That was weird. Definitely something I have never done again. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I heard that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Airplane hangar.
You could drop out of 11th grade and still understand that one.
Yeah. Continent. Okay.
And here's a guy who, by the way, who would show up at Orlando Magic games all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, when I was like, hey, I really want to do this interview. We got a bunch of stuff going on in his life, a bunch to talk about. They were like, well, can you fly to Turkey? And I was like, okay, but I live really close to where he lived. Okay, there you go. I got to interview Serena Williams a bit, especially early in her career, and having covered tennis at a time when Venus and Serena came on, and then really getting into it and talking to them about everything that they fought through and faced is something that is always going to be super special to me. And those are interviews I'm going to always really be so grateful to have gotten to do and had. In basketball, I grew up thinking Michael Jordan was Michael fucking Jordan. And the fact that in college, I got to like sit there behind a notebook and he occasionally spoke to me when I would be terrified. I didn't talk for like the first three or four practices that we covered. And you know how it is. You got this clot of media around you with their little stuff. And I was just trying to not be noticed and learn and do. And by like the fourth time, he just like looked at me in the middle of a press comp of people and was like, what? You don't speak? Do you not speak? And I was just like, okay. And then asked my probably ridiculous question at that point because I was so nervous. So when the first time I got to do like a real formal, this is official sit down with Michael Jordan, I was like, okay, I'm good. This is good. You know, that sort of thing. So there've been those kind of moments along the way where I felt like I've gotten to at least get a little peek about these people who have done extraordinary things, and that feels special.
To kind of add on to this, and this is not a normal quick hitter, but like I said, you enjoy what you're doing. So how cool is it to, like, how do you keep the fan in you in sometimes when you're getting to meet some of these legends or people you really look up? I don't.
But that's because I think it's easier because I'm not really a fan. As I've discussed, it's like the basketball team I grew up being a fan of. Okay, so I would be biased thinking that like George Mirason and Manu Bol were special. Like, I mean, anyone I am, quote, biased as a fan of is not, it would not bother anyone. Like, I have complete bias about Allen Iverson, and anyone who's been around me knows I have no chill.
Yeah.
I grew up loving Georgetown basketball and everything that man has ever done. I don't care. You cannot talk to me about. He is perfect. As I introduce him on the show all the time, he is our greatest living American.
Yeah.
But I think being open about those biases is fine.
Makes it easier.
Then when I'm excited and let the fan out of me, it's normally a of people who've done cool things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so I don't, I feel
it's
like
okay.
It's okay.
Right.
And it's never stopped me. And you guys have both been on the other end of this. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ask soft questions.
Not at all. Not at all.
I've never been one to ask the easy question.
You know, because I feel like if I am a fan of what you do and respect you, I'm going to have enough respect for you to think that you don't have this bullshit and soft shoe around you. Let's be real.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Your dream one-on-one interview, who would it be and
why? I need
the
Steven Jackson life story.
Oh. Wow. Rachel, you sure you ready for that?
How many hours would we have to do? We do like 60 hours.
We're going to need some time, Rachel.
Right?
Yep.
Right? That's good.
It's going to be some crying. It's going to be some laughing. It's going to be like, it's going to be some, what the fuck? Why did you do that? It's going to be a whole bunch of that. It's going to be a whole bunch of that.
Mm-hmm. But don't you think he's like the most interesting person
you
know?
Oh, man, he's been through so much, especially like his journey. And then now, post-career, like I said, for us to both be kind of reinventing ourselves for our second act.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I tell him all the time, no, but that'd be a definitely be one.
Mm-hmm. People would tune in.
Tell Jesse's story.
I would be honored, Rachel.
If you can relive one sporting event you covered in the past, which one would it be and why?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, the emotional part is like, you know, the night Kobe had his last game and dropped 60, the Warriors also won, right? They had this
beat the shit out of us. Memphis. We were in, we didn't get to see Kobe's last game, and they smacked us that
night. To win 73.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So... Sorry to bring up a sore
all
subject.
She remembered that.
They gave me the choice of being at either game. They were both on our air, by the way. One was on ESPN. Mm-hmm. One was on ESPN2, I think, or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I just looked. I was like, I'm going to the Kobe game.
Kobe.
And I think there was because the Warriors were so the story. And Kobe, yes, he had been on this sort of retirement tour. And there was a little bit less of like, well, we've seen him. We've done all of these waved goodbyes. You know, it's like Derek Jeter. How many times can you like wave at the crowd? And I was just like, no, I'm going to the Kobe game.
Right.
And it was... as incredible as advertised, and I don't need to relive it because it's still fresh and like whatever, but I mean, how much would you love to see him out there one more time?
Man,
so
energy. Oof.
There's a little bit of that, I think, I would like to see again.
Five dinner guests, dead or alive.
Oh, man. Allen Iverson, clearly. right? I don't know. I'm not good at this game. I mean, I think some of the women could be from 200 years ago, but who did their shit, no matter who was telling them what they had to do, those are largely who would make up my dinner guest list. And, you know, it's funny. We just had like women's impact. What are we calling
Women
it? Empowerment month, women's history month, women's appreciation month. I know it's how everyone feels about Black History Month too. It's just sort of like, oh, we get a month. Thank you so much.
Right.
What I would like is women not to be paid 80 cents on the dollar, across the country,
talk your shit, Rach.
And by the way, women of color significantly less.
Pop your collar, Rach.
So the ones who sort of were able to go through those circumstances, I think those are who I want at my dinner table.
Powerful.
And Allen Iverson, because he's Allen Iverson. Sorry, that's just going
to
happen.
He gets a seat with a bunch of great women.
Mm-hmm.
If you can have one guest on All the Smoke, who would it be and why?
Who do I want you guys to get into it with?
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's a good one. I mean, you've had everyone, first of all, so... I'd like you to get here with Michael with some cigars and that whiskey that we saw next to him. What was that? We feel whiskey, bourbon. What was that brown liquor?
The level of this shit kept going, and his eyes were changing colors in the process. He was killing it.
Right?
I would love to have MJ here.
I think we'd have to make that like a live show.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
MJ.
Because he's a guy who, again, I covered him while he was playing, both in Chicago and DC. And then I remember being in Charlotte for something when he had just started his ownership stint there. And I was sitting in his office and we were just kind of shooting the shit and just sort of talking about old stuff. And of course, like at the end of it, I'm like, Michael, like, why don't you come downstairs and come like be on with us? Like, come be on. And he just looks at me and goes, I don't do that anymore. Mm. He said, because I don't have to. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. And there you go. So he really does, one cigar aficionado cover like every X number of years. I think he's talked to Wright Thompson at our place once or twice, but he has not done anything like this. That is what I want to see.
That'd be big.
Yep. See if we can make it
Mike,
happen.
Mike, someone send this clip to Mike.
There you go.
Rachel said.
Look, Gina Paradiso, who
she can
holds
make
it down
happen.
For all your guests here.
Look at
G can make anything happen.
Come on, G. That's a lot, G, that's a lot of pressure, G. But we
got
faith in you.
She talking to me, so he's
I got no doubts. I am so grateful to you guys for the time.
No, Rachel,
just
thank you.
Thank you.
Space
thank
is so
you.
Awesome.
We finally
thank
got you
Rachel.
Here, so thank you. That's a wrap. All the Smoke, special guest Rachel Nichols, thank you for your time.
Thank
you. Catch this on Showtime Basketball YouTube and the iHeart platform Black Effects. We'll see y'all next week.
Walk in like a boss.
Juan the Spaniard Archuleta puts his bantamweight title on the line against number one contender Sergio Pettis.
Victorious!
Bellator MMA, live Friday, May 7th on Showtime, where warriors rule.